Jews and Genocide, another on genocide commentary by me, Kieran Kelly. Now, just recently I published an article on the refugee crisis as a result of an ongoing holocaust of genocide throughout the Middle East, North Africa and Central Asia. And the origins of that were in fact from a longer, more detailed piece I was writing on the way Jews associated with genocide and the use of exceptionalism, Holocaust exceptionalism, and so forth, to try and constrain the meaning of the word and control it politically. To tell the absolute truth, the only reason that the material for that article was separated out and published as it was because of the intervention of my wife, who insisted on me being sensible, and for once I didn't stop her. But of course, you can only be so sensible, because if you keep being too sensible, you just end up doing quantity surveying and stuff like that, and that is unfortunately what most people do all of the time, which is where we have got ourselves, how we have got ourselves into the position we're in today. So one of the problems with separating out part of an article is that it breaks the linkages that are there embedded in the article. And one of the things I want to highlight about the forthcoming material that I'm about to discuss about the Judaicide exceptionalism and so forth is that in the published article I mentioned that we have a socialized lack of statistical empathy. And a lot of people think that the our lack of statistical empathy is a naturally occurring thing because of the way our brains function. But in fact, I believe it's a socialized fact. We are presented with, throughout our lives, fait accompli, which make us unable to accept larger elements of suffering, so incidents of suffering. So we in fact have more feeling, we are socialized to have more feeling for the individual suffering than we are to have for the greater number of the more numerous suffering, even though of course in reality whenever there is large-scale suffering, you need only feel empathy for one person to get back to that level of empathy. But it is literally true that people tend to feel less for a million dead people than they do for one. But yeah, so this is a socialized thing, and I want to bring it back to part of the way we construct narratives about suffering, about all historical events really, which tend to fit political ends, basically. We like, well, power likes, and maybe we have a predilection for this as well, power likes to create narratives which are simple and easy to use, and we are witnessing this happening with the refugee crisis at the moment. And part of that is that now that we are suddenly licensed to feel empathy for these refugees who have been dying for quite some time, power structures which are in place want to create a framework around that which says that it is about villains and that they should act against those villains, which is why, of course, immediately this is being used. This suffering is essentially weaponized suffering, as all atrocity propaganda and discourses of humanitarian intervention are. They are weaponizing other people's suffering. This is being used to promote the idea of bombing Syria. Now, some are suggesting that the whole thing is some sort of setup. I think Thierry Massin pointed out with the iconic picture of the 3-year-old boy, drowned boy from Kurdistan, from Syria, that in reality, when drowned bodies are washed up on shores, they end up parallel with the shoreline. They never end up perpendicular to it. I don't know if that's true or not, but the fact is, it doesn't have to all be fake for the end result to be fake. We have so much mediation of what is going on in the world, and we have many systems which seek to exploit any event for a predetermined outcome. They spin it, they twist it, they use it like that. And it is not as if this crisis hasn't been building for such a long time that these things are quite predictable and easy to spin in that sense. So to bring this back to this whole question of Jews and genocide, I want to talk about some things that have happened in the past that show the way we as society, or perhaps the power structure is a better way of thinking about it, likes to create these simplistic narratives, and there is probably, in many ways, no better example than the way we have constructed visions of the Holocaust, which are quite often impressionistic, dark impressionistic visions, which fit in with another discourse of Nazism as a or Nazi Nazi governance as a kind of era of darkness, with the always with the noise of mass jackboots in the background, producing that sort of ominous cadence of mass thuggery. Anyway, so I seem to have spent quite a lot of time just blathering on about that. So onwards and upwards, I'll move on to the pre-prepared material now. Now, Zionists like to lay special claim to the term genocide on behalf of all Jews, but now anti-Zionists have taken to supporting this. Some anti-Zionists and supposed anti-imperialists have repeated the false claim that the term was invented to denote the killing of Jews. The only reason that I can see for this is to maintain a false image of genocide as an act of exceptional villains. In fact, genocide is a normal behaviour of imperial and colonial powers. Despite many attempts to rehabilitate empires as being some sort of noble enterprise, all imperial and colonial projects are inescapably genocidal. However, a number of Jewish nationalist ideologues claim that the only true genocide was that carried out by the Germans against Jews. These people are called Holocaust exceptionalists, and their claims are broadly understood by genocide scholars as being nonsense supported by falsehoods. It is fair to surmise that Holocaust exceptionalists are generally ardent Zionists. That is why I've been quite alarmed to see that their most central and fundamental lie being spread by anti-Zionists, anti-imperialists, and anti-war writers. That lie is the idea that the word genocide was ever in any way meant to be a way of describing Judaicide in particular. Now, I mentioned this a few commentaries ago, but one writer, Israel Shamir, went so far as posting that the word genocide was, quote, invented in order to stress the difference between murdering Jews and killing lesser breeds, end quote. Now, this lie is so easy to disprove that it's laughable. Anyone can spend 30 minutes reading Chapter 9 of Lemkin's Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, which I've now posted at my blog, And they will know that there is no way that Lemkin meant the term genocide to ex be exclusively applied to Jews or to the Judaicide that was happening even as he wrote. Now, when people refuse to accept or to re-examine a demonstrably false claim, it is because it is the essential foundation of a much larger lie, a central tenet of an ideology, basically. For Zionists, the obvious need is to make Israel morally immaculate and incapable of doing wrong, because they build a narrative where the alternative to Israel's actions is the return of a Holocaust or the risk of a Holocaust by making that the ultimate evil. They, by definition, anything they do has to be better than that and therefore morally good, you see. Holocaust exceptionalists have to perform serious mental contortions to avoid confronting the fact that genocide was not intrinsically related to Judaicide. But apparently, these Zionists are not alone in this. When I've tried to correct others on this issue, I've met with resounding silence and even censorship. The question is, though, why don't these anti-war or anti-Zionist people want to face up to this simple truth? What are they hiding from? Genocide, of course, and I would say this since I write about it so much, genocide is an incredibly important word. That is the reason that the meaning of the word is suppressed. It is a term like terrorism that is thrown around with great passion by people who would never in a million years be able to explain what they actually mean when they use the term. Many people bandy the term genocide with great emotion and no thought. However, there are also people who scorn others for inappropriately using the term when they too would be completely incapable of giving a real definition. The whole discourse between these two sides is even more idiotic than the sum of its parts, because it is like a debate without any reasoning. The conflict is invariably between a party who believes that it is a badge of passion, courage, and moral engagement to claim that something is genocide, and another party that believes labeling something as genocide is premature, rash, irrational, partisan, or lacking in scholarly standards or intellectual standards. You might wonder how this widespread idiocy came to pass. Well, it's quite simple, although I imagine you'll probably not think it is by the time I've finished explaining it to you, but let's just pretend it's quite simple. At the end of World War II, a traumatized world wanted to know how the events that they had lived to had come to pass. They wanted to criminalize the German and Japanese leaders, and they wanted to understand what had led these societies to cause such violence. And when I say they wanted to criminalize those leaders, they wanted to say they wanted to basically live in a world where you didn't go, you didn't live in a world where you just said that that's what the leaders of countries do. They felt that they needed to say this is wrong, it has to be wrong, which is quite understandable. People wanted to understand this as criminality and pathology as well. But there are two areas into which inquiring minds on these subjects could have wandered, which were metaphorically signposted with the big skull and crossbones and the legend "Stay Out" or "Verboten" or whatever. The first area relates to the war that had just been. The victors in this so-called good war were in reality drenched in the blood of the innocent, and that was a very delicate matter. We have just passed the 70th anniversary of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and there is still a suppression of the fact that those bombings were not military in intent. They were not aimed at winning the war against Japan, nor was the even more deadly campaign of firebombing that preceded the atom bombs. In fact, most of the so-called strategic bombing carried out by the US and the UK in World War II was simply mass murder of civilian populations, and it was militarily counterproductive, a misuse of resources that actually hindered the military progress. I could illustrate this in detail, but let me try to save time and effort by using a simple comparison. The Soviet Union produced more armaments than anyone else in the war, but they did not build bomber fleets to bomb German cities. To do so would have been an unthinkable, nearly suicidal waste of resources. The Western Allies had the luxury of wasting their most valuable materiel and personnel on a project of mass murder, but the underlying strategic calculus is the same. It was militarily counterproductive. With the deaths of millions of civilians weighing on the consciences of leaders and on the collective conscience of the peoples who had fought against the undoubtedly greater evil of Axis, the last thing anyone would want was the suggestion that the actions of the Allied leaders in killing civilians were in some intrinsic and essential way linked to the atrocities committed by Japan and Germany. Both collectively and individually, both consciously and unconsciously, people knew not to explore the notion that was any notion that would suggest that mass killings of civilians by Allies had any fundamental and immutable connection to the mass killings of civilians by Axis powers. This is best summed up by Justice Robert Jackson's opening statement at the Nuremberg trials. Quote, "The record on which we judge these defendants today is the record on which history will judge us tomorrow. To pass these defendants a poisoned chalice is to put it to our lips as well." End quote. Now please note that he is not talking about a future trial of a future regime, but he refers to the way history will judge us, meaning Jackson and his contemporaries. The discourse of aggressive war that was created at Nuremberg was closely and precisely shaped to construct a crime of which the Germans were guilty, but of which the Allies were not. That is why Hermann Göring at times shouted, "What about Hamburg?" and "What about Hiroshima?" Göring knew that was an illegal defence in and of itself, but he was trying to fracture the narrative framework with which the prosecutors and judges had legitimated themselves. And then there is another no-go area, another place from which the collective consciousness and most individual consciousness shied away in fear. In addition to avoiding any suggestion that Axis atrocities might bear any resemblance to the Allied habit of incinerating human beings by the tens of thousands, it was also imperative there be no suggestion whatsoever that Japanese and German conquest and occupation might in any way resemble the colonial and imperial policies of Britain, France, and the US. To be very clear, the Allies killed millions in World War II, but the Axis powers killed tens of millions. And within reason, aggression can justly be called, quote, "the supreme international crime differing from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole," end quote, which was a description applied to it at Nuremberg. Thus, to suggest there was a moral equivalence between Axis and Allied crimes is not really acceptable. And it is equally unacceptable to claim moral equivalence between Nazi crimes and those of communist regimes in the USSR or China. That said, however, the atrocities that the Germans and Japanese committed against the peoples of Europe and Asia inevitably resemble the crimes of other colonizing and imperially hegemonic powers. Both of these Axis powers, along with Italy, consciously wanted to repeat the imperialist and colonialist conquests of the British and French. The difference is that with changes in technology, the intensity and speed were unprecedented. What would have been 50 years of killing for the British Empire was squeezed into 5 years for the German Reich. Yet the principle was the same, and I cannot help but think that the main reason people saw a clear moral distinction between German imperial expansion in Europe and, say, British imperial expansion in Africa was that most of the victims of the Germans were white. Meanwhile, policies of deliberately and systematically killing civilians came to dominate the so-called strategic bombing of the UK and US during the war. They too bore chilling similarities to the policies of mass killing pursued by the Germans and Japanese. Eric Marcuzen and David Kopf published a book in 1997, I think, called The Holocaust and Strategic Bombing, which documents the parallels in the way the Germans and the Western Allies were justifying ever greater mass killings with pretensions of clinical detachment and inevitability, along with eerily similar euphemisms, such as the German evacuation and the British dehousing. The fact is that there is an essential and fundamental connection between the actual extermination of peoples, such as the Aboriginals of Tasmania, and the hyper-exploitation that led to the millions of deaths at Portisea and 10 million in King Leopold's Congo, and the social and cultural destruction accompanying the economic and political subjugation of imperial or neocolonial domination. Which you could see in, for example, the Philippines or Cuba after the US conquest of them after the Spanish-American War. Within that framework, there are also practices of ethnic cleansing and of any systematic attempt to reduce a non-military population through killing, preventing births, or reducing material well-being to lower lifespans. The Germans did, or attempted to do, all of the above to various people under Nazi leadership. In many ways, this project was inchoate and even contradictory, and yet viewed from a distance, it had a distinct singular form. One man, Raphael Lemkin, saw it and recognized it as, quote, a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups, end quote. He called that genocide. Lemkin had a profound insight which had three things in common with other fundamental changes in paradigmatic thinking. The first is that it had a long gestation. Lemkin didn't just base his idea on German policies under Hitler. He had been researching and thinking about these issues since he was a teenager, nearly three decades earlier. He was horrified by the Armenian genocide and spent his early adulthood trying to understand and encapsulate that violence, with the particular aim of making it an international crime. The second thing is that its significance was much greater than the originator himself understood at the time. Later, Lemkin himself, much to the detriment of his career and political standing, made a clear link between genocide and settler colonialism. He spent a great deal of his time writing about the genocidal destruction of the indigenous people in the Americas. In my opinion, he did this despite wishing to think the best of his new home in the United States. Had he lived longer, he would have been forced to confront the fact that imperialism is inherently genocidal even when it is not engaged in settler colonial expansion. Rather than seeking to impose the, quote, national pattern, end quote, of the imperial centre, it seeks to impose an imperial pattern, which is equally alien to the victim group, but which also cements their subjugation in an ethno-racial imperialist hierarchy. This is achieved with exactly the same social, political, cultural, and economic destruction and the same forced displacement sometimes and concentration and mass killing that characterizes settler colonial genocides. And that is true regardless of whether the empire is predominantly formal, informal, or neocolonial. The third thing that happens when new revolutionary ideas arrive is that people try to cling to outmoded beliefs and ways of thinking. They are resistant, and in the case of genocide, this resistance has been nourished by political interests and given a fertile discursive medium by the historical experiences of the internal and external relations of Germany's Third Reich. Obviously, this very dramatic racial ideology in particular. The nature of genocide was obscured from the very genesis of that term by a strident and loud imagery of Nazi exceptionalism. An exceptionalist emphasis was one of two opposing reactions to the unprecedented suffering inflicted on the world by the Nazi regime. The other emphasis was to try and understand what conditions had led members of our species to do or allow things that seemed to be unvarnished evil from the outside. A lot of good and bad things came out of that line of thought, but I would argue that it greatly profited societies to think of the German experience as one to be studied and avoided. It is from this tradition, which has always been at least partly relativistic, and relativism is almost, it's almost become a word of abuse now with regard to this, but if you don't treat something as relativistic, then you necessarily must treat it as exceptional, and we'll come to the why that's a bad idea later. It's from this tradition that spring concepts like Hannah Arendt's banality of evil and our understanding of the psychology of authoritarianism. I think that a very frightening aspect of contemporary life that we're living through right now is that our understanding of these Nazi traits fades, and as the understanding fades, the traits themselves become more and more manifest in ever more shamelessly inhuman official discourse. And I think that some of the callous comments regarding the refugees display some of this, and it seems that we have forgotten those lessons of Nazism. Two very striking recent examples are the US Law of Warfare Field Manual, which authorizes the killing of journalists, and a West Point professor who wants the military to kill lawyers and scholars who oppose military actions, and also would like them to attack mosques and various other enemies of US military freedom. In contrast to those who sought deeper understanding of Nazism, all forms of exceptionalism involve taking supposedly unique aspects of something and presenting them as essential and defining characteristics. This vastly overstates the substance of those aspects that are claimed as being exceptional, and if accepted, it makes comparisons impossible. That's the nature of exceptionalism. This exceptionalist approach can be seen in the famous Disney wartime propaganda film Education for Death. It is understandable that there was a desire to dramatize the oppressive and invasive nature of the Nazi regime, but the cartoon encapsulates a fetishistic approach and creates literally a cartoon version of reality. As propaganda, this is to be expected, but after the war, it wasn't as if people said to themselves, well, now that is over, I need to take a more nuanced view of National Socialist government in Germany if I'm to grasp the nature of that regime and its atrocities. The danger of exceptionalist narratives is that they deny context, and they refuse to allow comparisons, as I mentioned. The upshot of this is that people emphasize the wrong things in the fetishistic and cartoonish manner, which I also mentioned. Thus, US exceptionalists, for example, create a fetish out of the surface aspects of their constitution that they are formally and informally indoctrinated at a young age to view as essential parts of democracy. In reality, the excessive focus and intention given to the so-called democratic nature of US government actually makes it far easier for undemocratic power relations to develop and entrench themselves. If you obsess, for example, on the separation of powers or the intent of the founding fathers, you narrow your focus to that rather than sort of thinking of democracy as being ruled by the people, which is what democracy actually means. Similarly, an exceptionalist narrative about Nazi Germany emphasizes surface appearances and destroys any ability to learn and to avoid repetition. To use a reductio ad Hitlerum analogy, it's like saying that everything will be okay as long as the highest political office is not occupied by a man with a funny moustache. Now, here is a multi-choice question. The US has just won a war against the forces of darkness embodied by Germany and Japan. There is a new word around called genocide. Are you inclined to think that this word means A, what Hitler did to the Jews, or B, what Hitler did to the Jews and what was done to the indigenous people of North America in order to create the US? Please illustrate your answer with reference to the screen appearances of John Wayne. Clearly, no ordinary citizen of the victor states would want to think that the crime of genocide, which saw millions of Jews systematically murdered, was a very prominent part of their own proud national heritage. Canada, Aotearoa, the US and Australia didn't want to see their origins stained by comparison to the roving mass murders of the Einsatzgruppen. The USSR didn't want to see the terror famine in the Ukraine or Stalin's ethnic cleansing transmigrations as bearing any resemblance to the camps in which so many of their own died. And the old imperial powers, France and Britain, didn't want to see their bejeweled traditions of civilizing hegemony equated in any way to gassing children. In the fertile ground of Nazi exceptionalism that was already established through wartime propaganda, it was inevitable that Holocaust exceptionalism take root, not just as the explicit belief of hardliners, but also as the default starting point for general layperson's discourse. The base belief is that the Holocaust is the defining archetype of what genocide is, and that other events are genocidal to the extent that they can be compared to the Holocaust. What is this Holocaust that they are talking about? Well, part of the problem is that it is itself an extremely slippery concept. The real problem is that people don't want a robust definition of the Holocaust. They want to be able to know what it is without having to cogently delineate that knowledge. For most people, the Holocaust is emotive but vague. It is misunderstood, not in the manner that one might misunderstand historic events like the War of the Roses or the reign of Emperor Qin Shi Huang, but rather the impressionistic imagery is so powerful as to drown out actual detail. This is understandable, but still regrettable. The Holocaust is so overwhelming that a film like Schindler's List had to be made in monochrome because even the somber and washed-out cinematic tones that are conventionally used for Eastern Europe in World War II are insufficient for an actual concentration camp. Genocide is literally made out to be black and white. Our sensitivities to the issue are so high that misters used to cool visitors in Auschwitz today caused an international outcry because they were reminiscent of the what one news bulletin I heard called the Holocaust showers. There were, of course, no actual Holocaust showers. The realities are not any less horrifying than the nightmare images, but they are more complicated. In fact, the realities are more horrifying than symbolic beliefs like this image of Holocaust showers. And once you know them, you can't unlearn them, unfortunately, in some ways, I think. And that is why people create a totemic imagery of the Holocaust. They can feel all of the horror, the grief, and the outrage without the crippling depression. Most of all, they don't have to feel the burden of obligation to end suffering. Instead, steeped in dark cartoon visions of Holocaust showers, they are more likely and more able to inflict suffering because they are artificially separating the suffering of certain human beings from the suffering of other human beings of the same species. And, you know, I think I'm trying to reiterate here what I said about the use of Holocaust exceptionalism for Zionists. They can create this idea of it as an ultimate horror, but only if they don't really understand the detail, because on an individual level, the suffering is replicated in other places, even if not at the same scale. The symbolic or cartoonish approach to conceptualizing the Holocaust has the advantage that you do not have to be categorical about something to make it a defining character as well, so it's got this built-in slippage. It is possible to retain the notion that the Holocaust is encapsulated in the conspiracy of the final solution and the Judeocide and in the gas chambers of the death camps. Everything that is not part of that vision is either forcibly incorporated or it's completely ignored. To clarify my point, let me draw your attention to the role of A, gas chambers, and B, the final solution. These things are synonymous with genocide in most people's minds, but Lemkin never included them in his description of genocide for the simple reason that he didn't know about them. Moreover, if these things had not existed, it might have meant that many more Jews would have survived in relative terms, but most European Jews would still have been killed by the genocide policies that Lemkin described. Those Jews who died because of those policies were joined by many millions of others who died as a result of genocide. The final solution and the gas chambers are clearly linked to genocide, and that they are a way of enacting genocide that is entirely consistent with the logic of genocide taken to its greatest extreme, that of systematic extermination. These things are linked to genocide, but they do not typify, let alone embody, genocide. The end result is that the paradigmatic exemplar of genocide, the Holocaust, is a misrepresentation of itself, let alone genocide as a whole. For some, that means that the Holocaust was the only genocide. For most, however, it means that when one decides to use the G word, one constructs the newly acknowledged genocide as being a reflected image of the mythologized Holocaust. By maintaining that exceptionalist purity, one never needs to accept something as genocide if one does not want to. In fact, people get very angry when someone labels something genocide on the basis that to do so is to accuse the perpetrator of being as bad as the worst atrocities of German mass murder. Conversely, you can appropriate the imagery of the Holocaust for anything you don't like, particularly if you can label it anti-Semitic. In an extreme example, a man was filmed at a rally just recently, this was in New York, opposing the so-called Iran nuclear deal, where he yelled that Obama was releasing money to the, quote, terrorist Nazi regime which is building nuclear gas chambers, end quote. Kelly's Law. If you are attempting to establish the moral validity of acts by refuting any comparison to Hitler's acts, you are defending the indefensible. Most readers will probably be familiar with Godwin's Law. Quote, as an online discussion grows longer, the probability of comparison involving Nazis or Hitler approaches, end quote. The most common corollary is that the party that makes the analogy has lost the argument. It is dated now, and perhaps it was always more inclined to be used against critical thought than to promote it. I propose instead that what we need now is a law that states that if you are attempting to establish the moral validity of acts by refuting any comparison to Hitler, you are defending the indefensible. This is true whether the reaction is a gut reaction, such as the reaction of an Israeli who spits and yells with genuinely distraught anger at the suggestion that Israel is committing genocide, or whether it's the snide put-downs of a pundit or a politician or a bureaucrat or an academic who sneers at those who claim that the US or UK or France has ever committed genocide, or real genocide. The corollary of Kelly's law is that not only must the person refuting the Hitler comparison be defending the indefensible, but they must also certainly be demolishing a straw man in doing so. To say that someone has committed genocide is not the same as saying that they are morally equivalent to Hitler, in the same way that saying we evolved through the processes of natural selection is not the same as calling someone a monkey. For example, in his book Empire, Neil Ferguson first himself compares the actions of British forces during the Indian Mutiny to those of the SS against Jews, but then concludes that the British weren't actually as bad as the SS, as if that somehow makes things better. Nazi exceptionalism and Holocaust exceptionalism are in this sense the gift that keeps on giving. As long as you avoid building death camps with giant gas chambers and crematoria, then you can incinerate and starve hundreds of thousands. It's like Teflon coating for genocide perpetrators. It shields them from all serious accusations of intentional wrongdoing, because any attempt to suggest it's a systematic purpose behind Western mass violence is delegitimized as being an invalid attempt to equate our leaders with the Nazis. I fear that this tendency will continue until the point where Western governments, particularly the US, actually do become the moral equivalent of the Nazis. And that moment does get closer over time. People don't want to face up to the reality of genocide, because then they will have to admit that Western states are committing massive acts of genocide right now. Western interventions, most apparent in the Middle East, Africa, and Central Asia, have created mass destruction and mass death. The tempo of violence that exists now does not even match the bombing during the Korean War, let alone the enormous scale of violence in World War II. However, this violence never ends. It seems destined to continue for eternity, and the scale of death continues to creep upwards. Western interventions of many types have sowed conflict and instability, and they keep tearing at these open wounds, often blaming the victims. I cannot shake the feeling that if Germany had not been at war, Nazi genocide policies would have been enacted in the same slow accumulating pace. The destruction and the violence are often meted out by enemies of the United States, but I think people are beginning to grasp that to a greater or lesser extent, the US is often the creator and sponsor of these enemies. Moreover, these enemies are often materially dependent on the US either directly or through allied regimes. That is the new reality, or at least one of the new realities. Lemkin's understanding of genocide was of disparate acts that could only be related to each other when you grasped the underlying strategic reasoning. That is why anti-Zionists are embracing Holocaust exceptionalism. Israel provides such easy cartoon villains. Netanyahu and a cabinet full of political colleagues who seem unable to go 2 months without a minister openly calling for extermination or ethnic cleansing. They might as well have a leader with a funny moustache. But Pointing the finger at them is facile and comforting, but it is stupid. Israel does not have the power to effectuate all this destruction, nor does it control the US. Everything the US has done has followed a trajectory it has clearly been on since 1945. Trying to explain the current genocidal actions as being the result of the effects of the Israel lobby is like trying to explain the trajectory of a cannonball by a stiff gust of wind that arose during its flight without any suggestion that there might have been a cannon involved at any point. Here, of course, is where we come back full circle to the other part of this, originally the other part of this text, which I separated out and published as an article called called The Refugee Crisis and the New Holocaust. And, you know, if you haven't read it, the thesis is basically what I've touched on here as well, that the US has this coordinated plan aimed at destroying the essential foundations of the life of nations. That, you know, this is genocide, with genocide being defined as coordinated violence against peoples rather than against armies and governments. It's done under many different guises, but it is a coordinated plan, and this was a very, this is very consistent with Lemkin's original conception, because he was drawing together a lot of extremely varied actions on the part of the German occupying powers, who were, you know, he was making a comparison between they're forcing the people of Luxembourg to change any French names they had to German names. He's comparing that with basically mass murder and saying that these are things that all are part of a single strategy. And that is what is occurring now. So I will leave it at that, and you can reflect on the way this also fits in with patterns of trying to appropriate the suffering of the refugees in this refugee crisis to further the equally cartoonish imagery of Assad, the villain, or whoever else they may decide is the villain, ISIS the villain, that's fighting against the other villain, but never mind. Anyway, they, you know, you can see how these things tie in as well, and I think I'm starting to babble here, so I will just say goodbye. Goodbye.